You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future, from research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and welcome to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. I'm thrilled to welcome back my friend and colleague, Scott Lisoski. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be back.
So, Scott, you're known as a futurist, a visionary in technology, a technologist. You've authored a lot of books. How do you think of yourself? How do you introduce yourself?
Well, let's just first of all say not a doctor, right? So I haven't gotten up to your level yet. But I think of myself as somebody who's really passionate about trying to understand the full sweep of what is technology doing to the world. And there's half of me that is how is it impacting enterprises and industries? And then there's another half of me that is, how is it impacting people and humanity? But I was born into a father who was a programmer at Boeing. I started my career in technology when PCs were brand new. It just, you know, I seemed to end up being destined to mix that with my mother, who is a therapist and a counselor. And, you know, I became the mixture of those two, somebody who is a good technologist, a good visionary, but yet really has a humanistic side to him. So that's the way I think of myself.
I love that. And by the way, my father tells everyone that I'm a doctor, but not a real one. So
That's cold.
I know, right? Because I'm not a medical doctor.
I think you're a doctor and you're a real one. And I think that's fantastic, because I did not aspire to be able to go to that much school.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So the topic for today, we're going to be talking about data and how data impacts communities, people, payers, providers, and also outcomes. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you a question. When I was thinking about the technology aspect of this podcast, I asked my kids, who are teenagers, although we call them screenagers these days, I asked them, like, what are 10 questions that you want to ask a futurist or a technologist? And so here's a question for you. When will technology advance fast enough to undo the damage that human existence has had on the planet?
Wow. It's interesting you'd ask that. I just recorded a podcast with a lady who is an environmental expert in London. And we talked about the same question about the environment. You know, is technology progressing faster to save the environment than the damage we are doing to the environment? You know, we're just like, if there was a race, right? A race between how much we're damaging the environment and then how much technology can do to save it. So it's interesting that they would ask that question. The one thing that is amazing about what technology is doing is how fast we're innovating. So the pace of innovation is pretty incredible. I have to say, though, I've always looked at the innovation curves like a bubble. I don't think you innovate faster and faster forever. You know, I'm a big believer in what's called Kondratiev waves, that there is an innovation like an engine, right? Or in this case, the internet, or nanotech or biotech, right? And when we have those innovations, then there's a curve for a number of years where we have all kinds of innovation, and then that pace of innovation slows down. So I say that to answer that question, if you're saying, hey, is the pace of technology progress going faster than what we're doing to destroy ourselves? One of the things we have to recognize is there is a sped up or a slowed down pace of innovation with infotech. So let's say the internet, nanotech, biotech. And because you're in the, you know, let's say loosely in the healthcare space, you know, almost have to look at all three. And so it's a little more complicated. But if I just generalize the answer to that one and say, all right, is technology going faster than our ability to damage, you know, ourselves? I would say it's like 55-45, right? So I think at this point in time, the progress that we're making with technology and the good that technology is doing in the world is slightly outpacing the escalating damage that we're doing to ourselves. Because sadly, you know, I think the destruction and the damage we're doing to the environment, to ourselves, to our own psyche, to our own healthcare, our own mental health, I think the damage that we're doing is speeding up, which I don't know if you'd agree with this or not. You know, why are suicides going up? You know, I mean, we're at a point in time right now where there are more people committing suicide than there are murders or people dying in wars in the United States. And that's staggering. That's staggering.
Especially in younger ages.
Yeah. So I don't think we can ignore that, you know, there is a decent amount of damage going on in humanity right now, and that pace may be speeding up. But again, I believe technology is winning 55-45. You know, in that race, because it is a bit of, you know, there's maybe a bit of a zero sum game there, but it's a really good question to ask, you know, if you're a young person, because, you know, that is the world you're going to be living in.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, thank you. So in terms of data, last time we talked a little bit about data, you were a little pessimistic about where we are with data and kind of how data's doing. But we know that when we want to look at outcomes for healthcare, and then of course in behavioral health, you know, outcomes for people with disabilities or people with traumatic brain injury, we need those data. And as an industry, we haven't done a great job collecting them. Part of the problem is that our industry works, our science works off, you know, what we call single subject design, right? We monitor each person individually. It's really hard to take 100 kids with autism and say that you can control all the variables and your intervention is the thing that's responsible for the outcomes, because each person is so unique, their needs are unique, their learnings are unique, and where they fit chronologically on a developmental scale in terms of their skills is unique as well. So that's why we pride ourselves in the industry on building customized, individualized programs and not giving, you know, the same pill with the same dosage to everyone. So having said that, how should we be thinking about data? And I'd love to discuss this from the perspective of the client, the family who's receiving a service, the provider who's providing it, and then kind of the investors, the payers who are paying for these services.
Okay. Well, let's take them one at a time. And let's start with the client. And I appreciate, let me first of all acknowledge, and I appreciate that there are unique situations, you know, with every patient. And I do not believe that we should try to do a one size fits all or try to categorize, you know, people just to make things easier. So I want to acknowledge that. At the same time, I think it's irresponsible to throw out being able to analyze, you know, because data turns into analytics. And so it would be irresponsible for us to just throw it completely out and just say, you know, every child or every patient that we work with is an art project. And every art project is so different that we shouldn't track anything. And, you know, that would screw up the art of the art project. I believe that there are pieces of data that we can capture that would start to show us trends. Okay. And a lot of times trend analysis is really important. So for example, let's look at triggers. Okay. What might trigger 100 different, you know, people with autism is different, or the combination of triggers is different, but there's not an infinite amount of triggers. And there are some patterns that I think would develop with triggers. So let's just say that, you know, eating a lot of sugar, right, is a trigger. It's not a trigger in every single one because people's bodies are different and they can metabolize it differently maybe. But let's just say we figure out that in 65-70% of cases that sugar has something to do with being a trigger. You know, okay, now we know we have some analysis, right? Okay, if we do that with every kind of trigger, you know, then when we go in to do an evaluation, we could, you know, we could talk to somebody and find out that they've got a combination of 5 or 6 triggers, you know, which kind of just tells us that, you know, instead of intuition, you know, we have the analytics to be able to sit down with the client, possibly the families, right? And be able to say, look, this is not my, you know, just my gut feeling. You know, this is pretty scientific. It's data based. You know, here's a list of triggers. And when we see this kind of combination in triggers, there's a high percentage chance, right, that an event is going to happen. And I'm just trying to give you a simple example.
Right.
You know, every individual is an art project when it comes to what might trigger them. But over 100, you know, we can start to see that the, you know, that a combination of triggers is fairly likely. It's a lot like migraine headaches. You know, I know there's been a struggle for years and years to try to figure out what triggers migraine headaches. And it's different in different people, but we are starting to figure out that there's 10, you know, key triggers. Put four or five of them together, your odds go way up, right? That you might have a migraine headache. So right. I'll stop there for the time being.
So we would look at those. That's the antecedent, right? What comes before a behavior, right? Eating sugar, a bright light, too much noise, too much sensory stimulation. When we're talking about intervention, we're looking on the other side. We're looking at what comes after the behavior, which is the consequence of that behavior or the consequence of teaching that skill. Are we seeing skill acquisition go up, and is it going up at a meaningful rate? So when I talk to some payers, some of them have said to me, you know, we kind of break our kids into three buckets. We have some kids who are really doing well, making progress. We have some kids who are kind of not making progress. And then we have a big bucket that's just kind of stable. So if you want to think of it, for every month of intervention, they're progressing a month in skill development. So they're not really catching up to where they want to be. They're kind of just building a month at a time. So they think of it in these three buckets. So part of what we're looking at as a service delivery industry is, what is the outcome? What is the consequence of the skills that we're teaching? And so we collect a lot of data on that. We collect tons of data every day during every session. How many, you know, we're teaching him to wash his hands. How many times did he get that correct? You know, 8 out of 10, 80% or 40%. Is that going up? Do we get to a point where the child is mastering the skill? How would you think about data, you know, from that perspective, being able to say to a payer, we have great outcomes with our kids because we do A, B, and C, or because our data can show evidence that we've done something different?
Well, I think, you know, that helps the payers quite a bit. You know, any visibility, any, you know, analysis that gives them comfort, they're going to feel more comfortable. I mean, what a payer is not that excited about is an art project. Right. In the terms we've been talking about, that, oh, well, every child's an art project and you should just pay whatever needs to be paid to do the art project. You know, they're businesses. I mean, they're businesses, you know, or if they're not a business, they have to operate like a business. You know, they got limited funds. And so, you know, when you have an organization that has limited funds and they're trying to invest those funds wisely, or give them back, you know, wisely, they want data. I mean, they want analytics. They want to hang their hat on something. I have a concept for you. Okay. The concept that I think could be interesting for the industry from a client standpoint or a patient standpoint is that we need to start looking at the three time states of data. We need to say there's forensic data, there's real-time data, and there's predictive data, right? So we need to look at the three time states. And you and I just talked a minute ago about a predictive analytic, right? You know, based on triggers, we can start to predict, you know, when we might have, you know, a bad episode or something like that. That's predictive. You know, the forensic is, you know, here's what happened when we started. You know, here's the progress that we were made, you know, that has been made. The progress is on this curve versus their age. You know, that's all forensic. A third, the middle time state of data, which we haven't talked about, would be real time, which is they're wearing a wearable. And we can see data right now about what's going on. And so, you know, I think an interesting way to look at how to maximize what we could do for families or clients or the patient and build a good bridge with the payers is to really start maximizing the three time states, right? And really thinking in all three. What can we do in the forensic to show you past history, what's happened and progress? What can we do in real time so you can see right now what's going on, you know, which there's some really good benefits, as you and I have talked about real-time data. And then the predictive analytics of, well, based on what we've seen so far, right, based on what we know, based on previous analytics and previous science, you know, here is the glide path that we're on. So I like the idea of trying to apply all three time states to get the best outcome for a client or for a patient.
So with the data that we're collecting in those three states, is AI, I mean, obviously AI is going to play a part in this. How would that feed into AI so that we're actually getting those data, so that we're actually so that it's making a meaningful difference in the program that we're administering on a daily basis? I mean, can we get to that point?
Well, insightful question, right? The role that AI plays is, as people like me sit and talk about, well, let's look at forensic data and real-time data and predictive analytics, you know, at a practical level, you would say, well, wow, if we are a vendor, you know, I mean, if we're somebody actually providing the services, how can you deal with that much data from each client, you know, or from each patient? And the answer to that question is you have to build AIs. You know, you have to build an AI that monitors somebody's real-time data, of which there'll be huge amounts coming off their wearable. And then you have to be able to use AIs to do the real-time predictive analytics, because the underlying information is constantly changing. And so that prediction is constantly changing, a lot like trying to predict the weather, right? Constantly, there's 1,000 weather stations seeing something new. That's how we get so accurate at predicting the weather, is an AI is doing it. No human can do it anymore, of laying out all the weather charts and trying to make an accurate prediction. But, you know, this is the new Amazon Halo, right? So Amazon just came out with these, and the Halo, you know, they're trying to compete with Fitbit and Apple Watch now, right? So I got this just to test it out. So it does sleep and it does things like that. But you know what else it does? It does tone of voice. Okay. So it measures my tone of voice all day.
And, It's going to save all kinds of marriages.
Yeah, I'm not going to show it to you because you'd laugh, but it measures it and it says, well, your tone of voice was encouraging, it was uplifting, it was frustrated, or it was neutral, right? So for 2 days since I've had this, at the end of the day, I look, and every day the line for frustrated on me is bigger than any of the other lines. Now, I don't know if it just doesn't understand me, and it just thinks I'm frustrated and I'm really not. But the fact that we have wearables now that are measuring my tone of voice, you know, think about that for a second, because that's just one measurement. I mean, it's measuring my heart rate. It's measuring some other things, right? You think about if you have 100 patients that you're dealing with and you've got megabytes of information coming off of their wrist, like is coming off my wrist right now, there's no human way you can have practitioners monitoring that. The only way that we're going to be able to spin off lots of data to try to improve outcomes and then do alerts, right? Because you're going to need alerts for the real-time data and then be able to do the predictive analytics is with AIs. And then that gets into a really interesting question of, well, will each company have their own AI? Will each state in the United States have their own, you know, autism AI that they demand everybody uses? Will there be one industry-wide AI that everybody accepts as the only one that's the really smart AI? Right. That would be the next question that you'd ask is, all right, well, who's going to own the AI?
Yeah, well, that leads me to question of, I mean, backing up from AI, I think when you talked at the Autism Investor Summit this year, you compared our industry's use of data to a 1981 pit stop, you know, compared to where we could be. Maybe you can speak to that a little bit. But when we look at practice management, that's one of the challenges in the industry. We have lots of companies developing practice management and clinical software to collect data, provide reporting, do all the billing, do the tracking, verify fraud prevention, billing, you know, payroll. But how does one company differentiate themselves from others? Because if everybody signs on with ABC software, you know, you kind of all are reporting the same way. How do you then differentiate yourself? That's where the question of, is there going to be one, or is everyone going to develop their own?
Yeah. All right. Well, let me answer your question on the 81 pit stop. I mean, the reason I said that about the industry is I work across a lot of industries. And so I have this feel, this spidey sense, I don't know what you want to call it, when I look at the industry of how mature are you, right? How digitally mature are you as an industry? The word that I would put on your, what did you call the practice groups, I think you said?
The service providers.
Right now, the software that they're producing is highly transactional, right? It's transactional software. It's not analytical. It's transactional. And so its main purpose is to get billing out, you know, or to manage insurance, or, right? I mean, to build, you know, to maintain the relationships with the families or the patients. you are in the generation right now where you're just trying to get good transactional software, and there's very little analytical going on with it. You know, as the industry matures further, you'll build more and more intelligent analytics into the software. Or what will happen is other companies will build analytics, and then that software, they'll buy it, right? I mean, they'll buy the startups that are doing the highly analytical pieces of software so they can put it all into one big core piece. But this is the same, if I were to give you an analogy, banking. You know, banking has three big core providers, you know, Fiserv, Fidelity, and Jack Henry. And they started off, and for decades, a couple of decades, their software was just transactional. How do we clear checks? You know, how do we do online banking? They're just now starting to move into a lot of AI-based customer analysis, right? But this is two, three decades down the line from them just spending a lot of time and energy building core systems. So that's why I said the industry is behind, way too transactional in the software, not quite as analytical or building the kind of automation that you could build in. And so that's really the next horizon if I were designing and building software in the industry.
Is there an example of that kind of analytical technology in healthcare, or are we looking only to other industries?
No, I think you're starting to see it in healthcare. I'll step out of the autism space, right? But if you look at radiology, you have more and more x-rays or MRIs being read by AIs. And you've probably seen the articles that today, hand and wrist fractures, breast cancer, right? AIs are now more accurate than a human radiologist at being able to read those, right? Well, that's moving from just having, Epic software. Epic's a brand, right? Epic software at your hospital that's just managing insurance and managing, patient activity, moving into a world that's more analytical, right? More AI based. And so, yes, we're seeing it in healthcare. We're just seeing it in spots, right? I mean, it's just starting to kind of crop up, more analysis. Like if you look at an Epic system, starting to get some, patient analysis and some outcome analysis, but it's just early days, of that.
So we're starting to get a little bit of this in the diagnostic area. There are a couple of companies out there. I mean, I'm sure there are many, but the few that I've seen demos of are starting to use, I guess it's AI and their technology to do diagnostics. So the goal is, instead of spending 12 to 15 hours with a psychologist observing you, they're developing software where the child plays with an iPad or an iPhone for an hour. And through tracking facial expressions and eye movements in response to what's on the screen, they can diagnose autism. So I would think that's kind of what we're talking about, right? They're just comparing them to millions of other examples, kind of like Waze on the road and things like that, and very quickly able to identify, yes, this person has enough characteristics. What I'm wondering is, how would that play out with services?
Yeah, so there's one other component to that, though, about why could a machine, let's set aside iPad, right? But why could a machine be able to diagnose better than a human being? Do you believe that you can read my emotions really well? Just, you're a doctor, and you're a woman, and you're a pretty aware, woke, sensitive person, right? Do you believe that you can read my emotions better than a machine can?
Having been married twice, I would have to say no.
Yeah, which is a good
answer. I'm always misunderstanding what's behind the face.
Yeah, and that's a good answer, because as a technologist, I would say technology can see better than us. It can hear better than us. It can smell better than us. It can talk better and talk and interact in more languages, and in some ways better than us. So what is hard for people to understand is, you can build a machine that can see changes in your retina much better than a human can. A machine that can see the flush on your face much better than a human can. I just told you that, this is listening to the tone of my voice. It may be early days, but Alexa is listening to thousands and thousands of voices every second. You know, Amazon's going to be able to analyze, are people angry? Are they not angry? And you're going to say, oh, well, that's so different between person to person. And I'm going to go, no. When you've studied millions and millions of people and you're comparing the words they're using and the tone of voice and the volume, right, you're going to be able to make a pretty good shot she's angry. What I think sometimes people miss is we're building sensors and machines that have superpowers. I mean, compared to what we have, superpowers. Now, it isn't just that we can build a machine that might have a lot of knowledge on how to identify somebody who's on the spectrum. It's that we literally will be able to sense physical reactions in them and be able to sense activities at a much more finer detail than a human being can, which is the whole reason why they can read x-rays better than a human, right? A human has to take an x-ray, stick it up on a light box, and then use their eyes to try to see really minute distinctions, right? An AI can look at it pixel by pixel, right? That's why they can read a breast cancer, you know, scan better than a human being can, because it can read pixel by pixel and we can't. And that's hard for humans to get their hands around. It's hard for practitioners to admit and get their hands around that a machine might be able to have better senses and be able to be programmed to see things a human can't see, right? In a child that's autistic or somebody that's on the spectrum. You know, I know for me, you know, I am not as wise and intelligent as you are. In the technology space, there are a lot of software programmers that are on the spectrum. There just are, right? It collects people who are not socially adept, but extremely intelligent and analytical. And I've spent my life working with programmers. And I don't know how many times I've talked to a programmer, and after working with them for a little bit, in my mind, I go, okay, they're two notches over on the spectrum, right? But I don't know that. Right. That's just me applying my, you know, observations. Right. I don't have any issue thinking that there's a machine that if that programmer interacted with that machine, it would be able to make a much better statement, you know, about are they on the spectrum, are they not? You know, so anyway, it's a long answer to the question.
Yeah. So, I mean, that brings up other questions for me. But I mean, if you talk to a lot of the adults, the autistic adults that I talk to will say that, well, I think first of all, to comment on it, on what you were saying, it's kind of become a catchphrase, right? Now, anybody who's quirky or slightly socially awkward or maybe doesn't enjoy socializing, right? Everyone kind of says they're on the spectrum. So I think that's become a thing that people use. But if you talk to autistic adults, at least the ones I've spoken to, they'll say that I have social skills. I just don't have your social skills. I like to socialize differently. And you know, when we look at the brain in a fifth of a second is reading the face. I'm reading your face. I'm looking to see, are you smiling at me genuinely because of how, you know, your eye creases or your eye doesn't crease when you smile? Should I be fearful? Do I feel safe around you? So I'm assuming we're going to be able to train AI to provide assistive devices to people who maybe aren't picking up those cues to say, Scott's smiling at you, or Scott is friendly. Even though his tone of voice sounds frustrated all the time, Scott is friendly.
Absolutely, because the machine will have a better ability to sense things than we will. It just will. It'll be able to see tiny, minute differences in your eyes, you know, tiny, minute differences in your tone of voice, you know, that we just physically can't see because we, you know, our eyes are not that strong, you know, or we can't see in infrared or thermal. You know, I can't see in thermal. So if you're flushing, unless your face gets really red, Ronit, I don't really notice that you're flushing. Okay. So if I were to say something really embarrassing to you right now, I might not be able to tell, right? But a machine's going to be able to see minute differences in the blood flow on your face that I couldn't see. And like in my heads up display, it would be, she's flushing, you know, right? or she's lying, right? She's lying right now. So yes, you know, someday is science fiction as it seems. I think when you do an evaluation of somebody, you'll have a heads up display, right? And you'll have something in your ear and the machine will be listening and watching for minute changes that you can't sense and your heads up display will be, you know, telling you, well, ask this question, you know, do this thing. And then it'll constantly be analyzing and helping you to do the evaluation. And, you know, I know some practitioners are like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
Right. But sounds exhausting. Sounds absolutely exhausting.
But we will get there. I mean, I really believe we will get there. We will be co-working. You'll be co-working with a heads-up display and an AI. And the heads-up display and the AI will help you to make your evaluations.
So I think we have to do an entire separate one on how this is going to impact dating, because I have a lot of questions. I mean, can you imagine you're on a first date and this AI is feeding you all this information? She's not interested. She's bored. Ask her a better question. Change your tone of voice. I mean, it just sounds exhausting.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just the next natural step after you Google me, right? I mean, already you're using technology assist if you're dating. I mean, you're using, you know, Tinder or whatever to help you pick, you know, a likely date or mate. And, you know, then when you meet them, you're using technology to, you know, research them. I mean, we're already using technology in dating in a way we never did before. So I, all kidding aside, I think, you know, there would just be more and more technology that is helping us to find out, can we trust this person? Do we believe this person? And I don't think that'll necessarily be a bad thing.
Right. So back to where we are in autism, just to round out that conversation, from a service provider perspective, how can we best optimize the technology we have now for outcomes, for reporting, for, you know, for informing how programs should change?
Look, let's talk first steps. If I'm a service provider, you need to create your dream list of data, right? You need to sit down and forget how you would get it. You need to create a dream list of here are the data sets that we would like to have as service providers. You know, and so if I were consulting with a service provider, I would sit down and say, what's the data set we want on a client? What's everything we need to know about the family, you know, what's so the client. And then I might say, okay, a patient, you know, what's everything we need to know from the patient? What do we want to know in the three different time states? But I'm going to create a dream list of data, and I'm going to look at data as an asset, you know, data as a resource, raw material. And I'm going to assume that we don't collect 10% or 20% of the data today that we should or we could. So let's create a dream list of what is all the data we should be getting right now and start storing it somewhere, you know, so that we can use that data to do all kinds of analytics we've never done before. So that's the first thing I'm going to say to service providers is you got to start with harvesting much more data and create that dream list of what's everything we'd like and start getting as much of it as you can. That's step one. Step two, you've got to store it somewhere. It needs to be stored in a data warehouse, a data lake. You know, it needs to be stored appropriately so we can access it to do analytics. And a lot of service providers are not thinking about what to harvest and certainly not thinking about how to store it well so that you can use it. Third step is I start pioneering analytics that nobody else has. If I'm a service provider, A, I want to provide the best service. B, it's a competitive market. So I want to create analytics nobody else has. Fourth step, I'm going to visualize the analytics. I want to create dashboards. I want to create data visualizations that show me things about a patient that visually, right, that nobody else can see. I don't want my data in grids, you know, of numbers. I want it visualized so that it's very quick to see the details I want to be able to see. Last step, I want to automate it. So I want to collect it and I want to put the AIs on top of it. So it's kind of a five-step process that I would say service providers need to do, and they need to work on all five steps all at once now.
Okay, so can we talk about an example? Client cancellations, right? I mean, you've got client cancellations, you've got staff cancellations. So say you're working in a big city like Los Angeles, right? Big geography to move around. And you've got 100 therapists seeing 100 clients. And you have somebody in the scheduling department who has mapped out who's going to go to who. Maybe they're doing three sessions a day. They're driving between. What's the length of the drive with traffic? How long should it take? And now client A cancels. So therapist A is now available. So the goal is to deploy therapist A to another client where potentially the therapist has canceled, right? The goal is to capture as many hours as possible. both to keep your employees satisfied with enough hours and to get your families to get their hours. Now, there are containers around that. Payers may limit the number you can provide in a week. So if I cancel this week, I may not be able to make it up next week because I may exceed my hours. Now it's kind of moved to more of a 30-day cycle. It used to be weekly, but it's a big pain of management because, you know, right now, most of it's manual. You have the parent calling the scheduling department or texting them to cancel. Then you've got the scheduler sitting there going, okay, who else had a cancellation? Who can I match up? Can they get there in enough time? Are they too far away? Do they have the right clinical skills? Are they the right match for this family? I mean, there's a lot of manual work. And a lot of revenue is lost that way. And then it impacts retention of your employees because they may not be earning what they expect to earn.
Yeah, so it's a good practical example. You know, I would say Uber and Lyft have already had to solve a lot of this. So, you know, that should give you hope if you're a service provider that it can be done. Again, you know, what I want to start doing is harvesting and storing data on trend analysis. You know, when do people cancel? How often do they cancel? What's driving the cancellations? You know, is it whatever, there are reasons for why things cancel on either side. And I want to understand those drivers so that I can do more predictive analytics. You know, I don't want to have to constantly be behind the eight ball trying to figure out, well, it looks like it's going to be a bad day because three just canceled, right? I want to be able to do the predictive analytics to say, well, it's a Friday. And on Friday, we know there's a lot of cancellations. And not only that, the weather's bad. And so we know it's going to be even more cancellations. Well, I knew the weather was going to be bad yesterday. I knew it was going to be Friday yesterday. So I already should have known that I was going to have a lot of problems today. I could have been out in front of that. The problem that you've stated is a very real problem. And what I would say as a data person, a technologist, you know, if you really start harvesting the data, doing a lot of analytics, you'll have a much better ability to get out in front of it. You know, which doesn't mean that you can stop somebody from canceling, but you can figure out, well, what are the reasons that they're canceling? Can I give them incentives to not cancel? You know, think again, when I said Uber solved this, you understand that Uber and Lyft, they pay more when they have a basketball game letting out, right, at the Staples Center. And so they have a word for it, right? I mean, they have a word for what they call that rush. And you have to pay the pricing that is higher, right? So they've given incentives to try to solve the problem of how do I get a bunch of people to go to that area because I have a bunch of customers. Again, that's all data, right? They're using data to drive the analytics and the AI that's deciding on what the pricing is to get the behavior that they want. And a service provider could do the same thing on both sides.
How would that happen from a parent side? I mean, you've got to incentivize the parent not to cancel, right? You've got to incentivize the parent to maintain their session. So in a way, you're managing client behavior. I mean, Uber does that because if you cancel too many rides, they just cancel you as a client or you get a low rating, right? And then you have a harder time catching rides. I'm trying to think of how that translates from the client perspective, how you can use this technology to actually increase and incentivize them to attend therapy and not to cancel.
Well, I think, you know, as tough as it sounds, you start providing carrots and sticks. You know, if you are a regular, you always show up and you don't cancel, your rate lowers. You know, if you cancel, your rate goes up. You stop having a flat rate. You know, I mean, it's no different than the airlines. If you buy an airline ticket at the last minute, it's higher, you know.
Right.
And so you go to much more sophisticated pricing that gives rewards for good behavior. And it's the same thing on the practitioner side, right? Is if you cancel, you know, the more you cancel, the less you're going to make. The more dependable you are, the more you're going to make. You know, that provides an incentive, you know, for people to do the behavior that we want.
And that ties in the performance-based or the value-based, which is the next discussion I want to have with you next time on, you know, just where's the industry moving to? Because as payers are starting to look at value-based reimbursements, providers have to be thinking differently about how they meet those standards.
Yeah. You know, problems like what you have discussed, they're solvable. And too many times when you're in the industry, you know it's a problem and you never solve it. because you're not willing to make a radical change to the system. Whereas somebody from outside the system like me, my analogy is Uber and Lyft to the problem that you just said. You know, they put in a series of incentives to solve the problem. They created surge pricing. They didn't have surge pricing when they first started. They didn't, but they needed to change behavior. And so they created surge pricing. You know, the industry needs to create their version of surge pricing or, rewards and penalties. And then you'll be amazed how the behavior will change. Right? But you have to be willing to change a model that has been the same for years and years.
Well, we need people like you to help us do that because we're on the inside and it's a little tougher when you're on the inside. As you say, you just look at the disruption that this creates, right? It's easier to keep doing what you're doing, even if it's poor process.
Yeah, but let's talk about that because people will say, Scott, you're crazy. That'll never work here, blah, blah. Let me tell you what would happen. If you put this in place, what you would lose the bad practitioners because they would make less money. And you would end up attracting the really good practitioners because they know they can make more money. So, you know, let's just say if you just picked a number, you said, okay, we pay people $30 an hour. You say, okay, well, if you cancel above this rate, you only get $25 an hour. But if you're faithful, you get $50 an hour, right? I mean, if you go to that kind of model, the natural outcome is going to be the slackers will leave you and the really good performers will come to you, right? This is the kind of stuff I think people don't understand, or they're not willing to go experiment with a radical new model like this and then figure out, oh my gosh, this is the best thing that we ever could have done. It's fantastic. So anyway, maybe you do need crazy outsiders like me. I just think, maybe what you need is more people willing to experiment, more people willing to try to innovate with all the new technology tools that we have.
Great. Well, next time I want to get deeper into this conversation around outcomes, AI, and value-based. I think it's a fascinating conversation. There's a lot more to learn. So thanks for your time, Scott. I appreciate it.
No problem. And we could talk about data and the PE firms, right? And go even one step up as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Our industry, as you know, has changed dramatically over the last 5 years with almost 100 investments. So it's a whole different set of variables now.
Yeah. All right. Well, I look forward to next time.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.